United States Eventing Association's official podcast. Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Chris Stafford. Doug Payne has recently moved to a new training base in North Carolina with his wife Jess, having established a successful business at his parents' home in New Jersey. And he joins me now to explain what it takes to set up a new business. Doug, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you very much, Chris. It's always a pleasure.
Well, as I said, you have obviously new beginnings now. You've just written the concluding part of the articles series for the magazine. So we want to talk a little bit, I think, for the wider audience here about setting up a business, because there are so many aspects to this. And you have done this successfully at home before you got married, haven't you?
Well, that's the goal, right? It's certainly a challenge. And I think, starting any business, I'm sure, is a challenge and a half. But the equestrian world, the overhead is such that I think the challenges that are presented to anybody looking to get going is, can seem insurmountable at first, but I think you just sort of break it down and on we go with it, you know.
Right. Well, I guess it depends where you start, whether you start with the horses or you build up a team of horses, you start with owners, you maybe have some sponsors waiting in the wings. But let's assume that you're beginning your professional career, Doug. Let's start with a little shopping list for people to consider those, obviously key points at the beginning of setting up a business.
Sure. I can sort of, my background, and I think it probably would be of use, is that, basically the deal was my sister and I both ride professionally now. And when growing up, we were incredibly lucky to be in a family that's very involved with horses. And we both had a horse going, from childhood up through our high school graduation, and both went to college. And I think that is a very important thing to do. I've got a degree in mechanical engineering. And our deal was with our parents is that they sort of cover the expenses of a horse up and through high school, and then beyond that, it was anything we did was on our dime. So, I think everybody is in a slightly different position, but I think you've got to, and it's very difficult in the beginning, right? In your mid to early 20s, is to figure out a way to differentiate yourself. And if there ever is an opportunity with a horse that has some talent, and it doesn't even have to be a world beater, but if you can go and, win at training level, I think there's some huge value in that, because this time in the saddle, to me, is the most important thing you possibly can try and figure out a way to get more of. And, the more experience you have, then obviously then you've got to figure out a way to differentiate yourself from the person down the street, and hopefully you're continuing to learn, and I think your best teachers oftentimes are the horses themselves. So, the more you can learn, and the bigger the base of experience you have, then the more value you can be to potential clients.
Well, that's obviously true, and the balance is, of course, how much time you spend in the tack producing the horses and running the business and everything else that goes with it. And sourcing those young horses as well, Doug, do you have any tips for our listeners here about sourcing the young horses? Just because I know that riders, when they're beginning, will ride just about anything just to get the experience.
Sure. I think there's two parts in the way I approached it early on was sort of two parts. One is that you obviously, to get experience and certainly to get exposure, you need to be out there competing. So, if there's a horse that's a little bit tricky, and this is sort of the way I went about it, with a horse that's a little bit tricky, I'll spend as much time as I possibly can to figure out, how to sort of get the best tune out of them, and hopefully you can get some decent results that can start to gain some attention. At the same time, in the end, you would love to be riding, good quality horses that you ultimately can start from scratch or near enough. And if you've got the space, and I think this is, to me, is the only sustainable means to have a string of competitive horses, is that you've got to find young ones. And for me, that's anywhere from yearlings to three-year-olds. And if you can find them that are well-bred, and that's a challenge, but you can find a place to stick them, it doesn't cost all that much to keep them for a year or two, just out in the field. And, you know, obviously you've got to start them and get them going, but then you know you have a totally clean slate, and if well-bred and they look the part, they're probably going to be, you know, reasonably talented, and maybe they're not the world beater, but if started well, they'll have a good record, and they're always then will have a market if comes time that, you know, it's not going to reach the level that you would ideally like to be, but it certainly could be very useful for, you know, a number of other people.
Well, obviously, riding the horses, producing the horses to a level where they can be sold and start to generate revenue is a priority. But let's focus, if we would, Doug, on what happens when you're out of the tack, all the other things that happen in the barn that you need to focus on to maintain a successful business. And there are so many aspects of that. I don't know if you want to begin in the barn or in the office.
Let's start out of the barn first. I think in this world especially, never more true is that perception is reality. So I think from day one, you've got to figure out whatever successes you might have. And you know, I think oftentimes people think, well, I only, you know, I placed, you know, in the top three at a, you know, a unrecognized competition or whatever, and that doesn't mean anything. But you know what? There's so many people out there, right, that ultimately that is something that they could dream of finishing with a ribbon someday at a competition of any sort. So I think, you know, if you can figure out a way to get a website up, get, you know, it's easy now with also Facebook, create a business page to that, Twitter, all of the social media stuff, and any success you possibly have, you know, try and make the most of it. And it's not that you blow it out of proportion, but I think, you know, oftentimes we get wrapped up in thinking, well, I don't have the results of a Boyd Martin or something like that, and that's going to be, you know, I can't possibly compete. But there's so many people out there that strive one day just to go to a competition, period, regardless of level. And I think you've got to keep your mind very, very open and continue to put out a message. I think you need to refine basically what your goals might be and continue trying to work that message out into every, you know, informally sort of press release, any competition or any bit of news that you can possibly put out, you know, put out your goals and let people know. And the larger the network you begin to create, the more opportunity will present itself.
Well, I think the point you're making there, Doug, is that when you start off, you're not going to be competing directly with the team riders, for example, that have established careers. You want to be thinking globally, but acting locally and looking at your local market to establish your business.
Yeah, very, very well said, actually. You know, and I think the thing is also that you cannot discount how critical I think both of blogs are, you know, email, people do newsletters all the time, any of the social media stuff, because, you know, you really want to hook, to me at least, the people that I've been lucky enough to garner the support of, you really want them to be invested in your journey, and you want them, and it's critical. Without them, you can't continue. I mean, I couldn't keep going day to day without the support of a number of people, and being that, you know, in some ways they're allowing you that opportunity, but you need to give them, you know, sort of give back to them in that they are a critical part in this journey, and share the experience with them. And so if you can ultimately share that experience with a really, you know, a very wide group of people, that's only going to start to gain attention and gain support. And I mean, in the end, that's whatever, you know, all of us need. It's not an individual sport by any way, shape, or form. I mean, yes, on the field of play, it sort of appears that way, but without an incredible team behind you, you're in deep trouble.
So look to your immediate family and friends, people who've maybe supported you since you were a child with ponies, and you never know who knows who's in business and could potentially become a commercial sponsor. It becomes an extended family, doesn't it, at the beginning there?
For sure. And yeah, and the other thing is that extended family will continue, you know, indefinitely. And I think, you know, sometimes somebody will come along and you know, I know a number of contemporaries that initially started out thinking, well, you know, I'm going to have some big sponsor come and buy me a string of horses right off the bat. And to me, it's just not going to happen. You know what I mean? So it may be something as small as, you know, somebody says, okay, I'll pick up the shoeing bill on the source for you, or I'll you know, help out and maybe I'll pay an entry or two or whatever it might be. I mean, however small it might be, jump on the chance and, you know, hopefully share the experience with them. And from there, it will probably grow. And if not that person, they probably know somebody else that might be interested and might want to join along as well.
I can hear some of our listeners wondering, Doug, that that's all very well if you have family behind you, you have the facilities, you have property, and you have the wherewithal to get started whilst you're still with your family. But say you don't have the benefit of family involvement in the sport and you have to go it alone. You may have been a working student with a top rider.
Sure.
You've got some experience. You think, okay, now is my chance to break loose and start on my own. So what would you suggest to young riders who are thinking of doing that?
Sure. I mean, I think if you can hook up and be a working student for, you know, if you have no family involvement whatsoever, find a way to get yourself in with a sort of a program that it doesn't even have to be producing world-class horses, but seems to have a business model that appeals to you, that you're drawn to. You know, it might be someone that just in the end would love to have a huge lesson program. Find a barn then that produces, you know, that ultimately is able to produce that. And if you can, you know, I mean, if somebody walks in the door here and says they really want to help out and, you know, they can only be here 3 days a week, well, that's great. You know, we're welcoming people like that in actually all the time. And I think the advantage there is that there is a lot of insight that you're going to miss if you're trying to just do this outright alone. And if you can hook up with a program or a business that's been successful, there's a lot of key points and tricks of the trade, more or less, that you're going to pick up as you go. Now, if you can do that 3 days a week, then it gives you another, you know, 4 days a week that you can, you know, start advertising. Go to your local pony club, or go to, you know, a 4-H situation, or, you know, just plaster advertising around all the local tax stores and such, and you just try and pick up, you know, small business. And it may be you're going to probably for the first couple of years be running around to a lot of different barns to teach, you know, lessons for maybe kids, adult amateurs, whatever it might be. And you're going to probably spend more time in your car traveling around than you are riding horses. But I think that ultimately is your foot in the door. And then a couple of years down the line, you're going to come to a saturation point where you can't possibly continue traveling to teach as much as you are just because of the demand. In which case, then I think then it becomes, financially, it makes a whole lot more sense then to, you know, rent a barn or rent a portion of a barn, and then you can start to centralize your business and people will then start to come to you. But in the beginning, don't be afraid of the time you're going to end up spending in a car, because it's, I think it's a necessary evil. You need to get enough business going that in the end people will start to come to you. And that's only going to happen when your time is ultimately tapped out.
Well, of course, the other aspect to this is actually the paperwork, Doug, and running the business. And I'm thinking that it's going to be listeners who are wondering how, if I don't have a degree in business or I've never went to business school and I never learned to do the bookkeeping, how do I deal with all that aspect of it? I mean, what would be your advice there?
I will tell you, I hate paperwork. I've actually, the best thing I ever did, the first couple of years, I just did it all myself. I, you know, bought QuickBooks and sort of figured out how to do that. And I did hire an accountant for the actual tax situation, because to me, it's a bit overwhelming. And I'm sure there's, you know, ultimately in this business, there's a lot of overhead. So you're able to write off a whole bunch, but I wanted to make sure that I was sort of doing it on the up and up. So invest some money, get an accountant. The best thing I've done since is to hire a bookkeeper, and in the end, it costs, you know, less than $100 a month, probably not even. And they are able to sort of make sense of the whole mass of transactions. I basically just give them my, you know, bank information, and they go through each of them, and monthly then we'll have a call and just sort of go through what, you know, if there's stuff that seems abnormal, you know, how that would be classified, and basically then the bookkeeper then can go back and forth with the accountant, and they can figure out sort of the nuances that I, you know, I'd be lost with for sure. And then the other thing that that I've gone to in the last year or so is that there's an app that I use called Invoice ASAP, and it's been awesome. So any lessons or horses that are in training when they go competing or whatever, snap on the phone, you can say, okay, you know, we had so such and such for an entry fee or, could be anything, you know, worming or whatever costs that horse might accrue over the month. You can just type it into your phone real quick, and it actually generates a PDF invoice that then could just be emailed off very quickly. And that has been a massive savings, because if you wait to the end of the month to try and remember all the stuff, to me, you end up missing stuff, and in the end, it's going to be your bottom line that's suffering, because there's just a lot of stuff that happens throughout the month that just sort of goes unnoticed otherwise.
Well, obviously, there's the bookkeeping is critical, and that, but there's also the other aspect of the legal aspect of running a business too, isn't there?
Sure,
Doug, and the things like bill of sale and sponsor contracts.
For sure,
like that.
For sure. Yeah, I've got a again, sort of on the legal side of it, good friend of mine who actually started off as a student by the name of Lori Rieger. She's actually starting up a business doing just this, sort of rider services, and she is an attorney as well, and certainly could give you her contact info for the show notes if it's of interest. But she would be the one that generates all of the, you know, all the contracts and our liability releases and training board contracts, all of that sort of stuff. And, you know, for the first few years, I actually had written it up myself, and probably not the smartest decision. And, you know, it seems like it may be an expense that, you know, you can't afford at the time, but it's money absolutely well spent, and you got to figure out a way to do it, because without the, you know, you hope and the intention always is to keep, you know, all your business transactions and everything on the up and up, and you don't think there's ever going to be, you know, any sort of falling out or whatever, but, you know, you just never know. And so you're much, much better served to make sure you've got that. And obviously your equine, your insurance and your liability insurance for that, just take a little bit of time and go through it and just make sure you're covered, because without it, you know, it can be devastating for sure.
I think it's also important, isn't it, Doug, to lay out those ground rules, those expectations, if you will, between you and the owner, or you and a sponsor, yeah, or vendor, or whoever it may be, that relationship is going to last you a lifetime if you get it right at the start.
No doubt about it. And, you know, I think it's something you learn through time, but I know initially I was way too lenient, and you know, you totally bend over backwards and make every accommodation you can, and you initially feel as if you need to offer them the world, you know, and over time you'll realize where your limitations might lie with time or commitments to others or whatever it might be, and so you just need to sort of revise or rein back the expectations from the beginning and say, okay, you know, somebody comes in the door, gives a phone call and says, I want to send this horse, or I want to start taking lessons. And, you know, the way I've worked it of late, and it's been working, you know, absolutely great, is just to say, here's the deal. I'm on the road a lot. We compete a lot. And, you know, ultimately, to be totally frank, that's probably the reason that they're coming in the door. And I said, you know, the downside to that is that there are going to be weeks that, you know, I'm only here a couple of the days, and, you know, when I'm home, I will be there to help either teach or ride your horse or do whatever it might be. And the times that I'm away, we've got very competent people that can sort of fill in my shoes. But initially, I probably ended up overcommitting, saying I'll do, you know, 6 lessons a week, you know, indefinitely, and it's just not realistic. So you've got to be so honest, I think, in the beginning, and then people totally appreciate. Because, you know, if you under-promise, over-deliver, everybody's happy. You know, if you over-promise, there ends up being a whole lot of tension, and it leads to a whole lot more stress on your part, because you think, well, I'm being pulled in all these different directions, and there's no possible way that I can keep my head above water. And it'll drive you nuts. So be upfront in the beginning. Know your time commitments, what you're able to give and what you're able to offer, and you know, just be, like you say, be straight with people in the beginning.
Well, in summary then, Doug, can you give us a kind of startup checklist for people to consider when they are getting their first piece of paper, it's a blank, and they don't know where to begin?
Sure. I think you're on it. You're totally dead on. The legal side of it, you need to have liability insurance right off the bat. And there's a number of different insurance providers. And the nice thing there also is that they will guide you and tell you exactly what is needed and what they require. You know, if somebody comes for a lesson here, you know, we have a liability release. If I didn't actually have one, my insurance agent should be able to point me in the right direction. So I think you talk to your insurance agent, make sure you have your, if you have horses in boarding, you've got care, custody, and control insurance, and then you also have your liability for teaching. Make sure that's covered. Once you're covered there, then God forbid something horrible happens, you know, at least you have the backing of your insurance company. And then, as far as the bookkeeping, do your best to at least have an accountant that can overlook, you know, sort of oversee all your transactions for the year. It could be, you know, very well could be something that you just grab QuickBooks and do it yourself, but I would definitely have a professional take a look before the taxes are actually submitted. And then on the, you know, on the promotional side, if you can get yourself, get a website going, first thing, easy enough would be obviously through Facebook and Twitter. But there's a lot of services now, I think through Squarespace or, if you just go to GoDaddy, they have web creation services. It won't be crazy expensive. You don't need an elaborate website. Just have a couple pages that just sort of tells your story and tells what, you know, sort of describes what services you can offer. And then try and just continuously be plugging away at it. And from there, go and get as much experience in the saddle as you possibly can. And you know that you have all the underpinnings there, and you're going to be in good shape. And any success you have, small or large, make a big deal out of it, and go from there. And like I said, if you do right by people, you know, everybody talks. And so, you know, if people have good experience, they'll tell all their friends that they've had a good experience, and sure enough, you'll end up picking up some of their friends, and it sort of snowballs over time. But it's not going to lie to you, it's not an easy industry, not an easy business to be in, but I wouldn't trade it. You know, I really have no complaints whatsoever. It's I'm very, very lucky to have the opportunity I've got.
Well, as we know, success is based on hard work, dedication, and not forgetting that everybody you meet could lead you to something better.
Absolutely.
All right, Doug. Well, thank you very much indeed for coming on the show and sharing your experiences. It's obviously working for you. Good luck with the new business. I know you're developing things fast down there in North Carolina.
Yeah, no, thank you very much. And hopefully we'll be back on next spring. We've got the farm hopefully be up and running in the springtime. And it'll be very exciting for sure.
And you can read the concluding article in that series by Doug Payne in the November issue of the magazine. You can also read a complete review of the USEA Neutrina American Eventing Championships, an article about bloodlines, and a preview of the USEA convention. Don't forget, this podcast is available for download from the iTunes Store to your smartphone podcast apps. Until the next time, enjoy your eventing.